want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
My thanks to great listeners like Russ Archibald in Hawaii, Don Cisney, Gillian Hurst. Yeah, the Hursts support this program, and Wendy Bloom. They are voluntary subscribers. You can do it, too. Go to peterbcollins.com, and our voluntary subscriptions via PayPal start as low as $5 a month. Thanks for your support. David Bowie opens our show today. It's a criminal, criminal world. And today's podcast focuses on two activist efforts to right some wrongs in American governance. In our second segment, Ben and Jerry will join us. That's right, the real Ben and Jerry, Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield. And they are leading an effort to amend the Constitution to correct the defects imposed by the Roberts Supreme Court in the ruling a year ago in the Citizens United case that unleashed millions, if not billions, of dollars from corporate coffers into American political campaigns. And I'm delighted to be able to talk to Ben and Jerry at the same time. I've talked to Ben many times in the past, but my first opportunity to get them both, and you'll hear that coming up shortly. But first, Shahid Buttar returns to our program today. He is the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and he is engaged in some activism in Washington because a lot of people aren't paying attention. The Patriot Act is about to be renewed again. And you haven't heard a thing about that, right? Well, that's the way the leaders in Washington want it, because they want to quietly renew it without any amendments, and this is quite a frightening prospect. Shahid, thanks for joining us, and thanks for fighting for us.
Thanks so much for having me on, Peter.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I want to start our program today with the audio from a YouTube video, and I'll throw up the link in the show file with this podcast. But you made some powerful remarks and laid out some great rhymes in a demonstration just a few days ago on Martin Luther King Day in front of the J. Edgar Hoover FBI building in Washington, right along Pennsylvania Avenue there. And I want to start our conversation off with your performance here, and then we'll talk about the issues related to the renewal of the Patriot Act. So here is Shahid live on, it was live on Monday this past week, Martin Luther King Day in Washington, D.C.
The FBI refuses to defend in public its own policies. And there's a good reason for that. Their policies are indefensible. Yeah. Attorney General Eric Holder recently recommitted himself to the FBI's abuses of civil rights, defending, for instance, the operations where the FBI will infiltrate a lawful group, bribe unsophisticated or mentally unstable people to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money, in FBI-initiated plots which will be trained, equipped, funded by the FBI, and then prosecuted as supposed terror. Meanwhile, 20 activists across the Midwest have been subjected to secret grand juries, and Muslim American faith institutions around the country have been infiltrated. The FBI is more worried about harassing peace activists and bribing Muslims to participate in fake plots than they are in actually addressing real instances of political violence of the sort that left a federal judge dead and a member of Congress in an intensive care unit 2 weeks ago. We do want the FBI to enforce the law. We want the FBI to enforce the law to everyone. And we want the FBI on today in particular, the day we're called to pay homage to Dr. King, to respect the Bill of Rights and perform its job as a law enforcement agency rather than a law violation agency. So I'm going to just kick a rhyme one time about warrantless surveillance, government spying, telecoms giving agents data that we're all buying. You can ask to see the policies, but they're still lying. When you're on the phone, the NSA hears you crying. We got JTTFs. We've got fusion centers. If our nation was a car, we already lost the fender. It was the Fourth Amendment. Now so much ink, it's been lost by a people who follow but don't think.
Yeah.
We follow but don't think.
Right.
Follow, don't think that intelligence collection aims for prevention. To stop crime before it happens is a stated intention, but they don't mention that we're tracking old ladies. Investigate this state. The mission is shady. So we won the Cold War, right? We won the Cold War. We integrated East Germany, but now, intimidated by terror, we sacrificed liberty. Before they left D.C., Bush and Cheney turned the FBI into the KGB. There are 800,000 police across the country now monitoring your activities. You can't take photos. You can't take videos. You can't take notes. You can't draw. You can't blow your nose without your face ending up in a government database. Why? Because intelligence collection aims for prevention. To stop terror before it happens is the stated intention, but they don't mention that once you're on the list, straight up your behind goes the government's fist. So authorities collect information, they share it across agencies, even though the Constitution protects privacy. Transition in the White House, wait and see, they're still asserting executive secrecy. What'll it be in these Obama years? Hope, all you want. But keep the same fears. We are all getting ground up in the same social gears. Freedom ain't free yet, y'all. We owe it in arrears. We face an aggregate, accumulated democracy deficit. And once it sticks, brothers and sisters, that's it. Because intelligence collection aims for prevention. To stop dissent before it happens is the intention. They don't mention that we're talking thought crimes. Ideas in your head. The FBI has criminalized our minds. Thank you for being here on MLK Day.
Shahid Buttar in front of the Hoover FBI building and right behind a free Bradley Manning banner. And Shahid, you made a number of very important points in your speech and rap there at the FBI. And first and foremost, let's talk about the Patriot Act, because this was rammed through right after 9/11. It was a bunch of pieces of legislation that had failed to even get out of committee in most cases in prior attempts to pass it. And with the impetus of the alleged terrorist threat, what we saw was this crackdown on our civil liberties and the early foundation for a police state. And while we were comforted slightly at the time because it included expiration dates, it has been routinely renewed without much debate and with only a few attempts to amend it. And last year, while we were distracted by the final battle over Obama's health insurance reform, they silently pushed it through and renewed it for another year. And that expiration date is approaching in February, and I am pleased that you're not going to go silently. First, tell us, just in a thumbnail, what's wrong with the Patriot Act and why it should not routinely and rubber-stampedly be renewed?
The Patriot Act basically is a law that, for at least some category of law enforcement activities, suspends the Constitution. It says that despite the Fourth Amendment's requirement for a judicial warrant for unreasonable searches and seizures, the authorities can, at a whim, for basically no particular reason, and with no judicial warrant, no check nor balance, in secret, without transparency, request information as sensitive as your medical records, your financial transactions, your, you know, the FBI is now seeking email metadata, transaction history, so the idea, you know, figuring out who you talk to, when and for how long,
right.
Data mining all this data, and then using it as part of a sort of tool to try to predict where crime will come from. And there's a whole host of programs that come together that are worse than the sum of their parts. The Patriot Act is a visible pillar of that set of policies.
And at times, there were Democrats who opposed it. Russ Feingold in the U.S. Senate is gone now. He was taken out by a corporate Republican, Ross Johnson, and his efforts to slow down the extension of the Patriot Act in past years were notable. Is there anybody who you can identify in the United States Senate who will even raise issues and attempt to provide amendments to any proposed renewal of the Patriot Act this year, Shahid?
I certainly hope so. There are a number of people who were allied with Senator Feingold when he was still in the Congress, people who were willing to stand with him, if not take a leadership position, people like Senator Durbin from Illinois or Senator Whitehouse from Rhode Island, at times Senator Leahy from Vermont, who's the chair of the Judiciary Committee. We don't currently have a very clear sense of their willingness to stand firm on these questions. You know, part of the problem here is that with President Obama pushing the Patriot Act instead of President Bush, it really does change the equation on the Hill. And I fear that if the administration continues its course from last year in its race to mimic the Bush administration, it will unfortunately leave little room in either the Democratic caucus, at least, for senators to resist that.
And Shahid, what about on the House side? Because we have a whole new composition there. And one of the positives is that a lot of conservative Democrats, the Blue Dogs, didn't get reelected last November. So arguably, the Democratic minority in the House is more progressive than the Democratic majority that they had just a year ago. And it's an open question whether any of the freshman Republicans, 60 or more, will take a constitutional position consistent with the views that you and I hold.
I think you're exactly right, and quite frankly, that was exactly what I was going to say. I think that on the progressive side of the House, there are certainly a lot of people who remain concerned about the Patriot Act, and I think have been throughout. I was just on a panel this Tuesday with Congressman Holt, Rush Holt from New Jersey, mm-hmm. and he is very concerned about it, certainly, and I think that people like Congressman Conyers in Michigan, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, I think there will be a lot of concerns from that side of the fence, and I think that it does remain to be seen, but I think that there is some hope that the libertarian-influenced incoming GOP freshmen will, true to their rhetoric, be skeptical of the government here, and attempt to rein in some of these abuses. Now, you know, whether or not they will be able to resist the pressures of their own caucus, I think this will be an early test. I do hope that to the extent Americans are concerned, I think people from all walks of life should be. I think that we do have some opportunities, I think, to press our members of Congress and encourage them to be mindful of their responsibility and their oaths to defend the Constitution. You know, one thing here on the GOP, freshmen in particular, there was this relatively theatrical event recently where in the House, the mm-hmm. most of, not all, but much of the Constitution was read out loud. It's a rare event.
Right.
And at the time, the controversy that was generated was particularly around its exclusions, you know, what they chose not to read. What struck me at the time, and what I think is very relevant to this conversation, is the question on the table is, did they understand it? And do they understand it? And when called on to vote for a constitutionally offensive legislation like the Patriot Act, which really shifts the degree of liberty that we as Americans enjoy and really mm-hmm. expands the authority that the executive branch has, you know, will the legislative branch mind its constitutional responsibility to check and balance the executive? I really hope so. We will find out very soon.
Now, I did consider it, like you inferred, political theater for them to open this session of Congress reading the Constitution. That said, it was interesting that Gabrielle Giffords, who's recovering from the shooting in Tucson, and it's nice to see making a dramatic and remarkable recovery, she read the First Amendment. Do you happen to know who read the Fourth Amendment in this this show reading of the Constitution? I don't, but you might.
No, I don't either. I was going to ask you. I don't know, but that would be an interesting thing to find out, I think.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned John Conyers a moment ago, and just a friendly correction, he's no longer chair of the Judiciary
Indeed.
Committee.
Right.
And it disappoints me
much to my chagrin.
Indeed. that in the last 4 years, when the Democrats were in the majority and he chaired Judiciary, he was leashed. He wanted to impeach Bush and Cheney, and Pelosi wouldn't permit it. He finally got this impeachment light where Kucinich was permitted to file his articles of impeachment and argue for them, and then it was a one-day story and shut down. And it really pains me to see a great man like John Conyers, who was fenced in, caged in by the Democratic majority and the desire to get along, go along, and as Obama calls his obstruction of justice plan, looking forward, not backward. Do you have any indication that as he returns to ranking member in the minority, that we're going to see a feistier John Conyers who doesn't let the White House or the House leadership silence him?
That's a really fascinating question, and to be frank, I don't have an answer for you. I certainly hope so. I do know that Congressman Conyers is older than he once was, and I don't know to what extent he has the same energy, perhaps, that he did earlier in his career. I think that there are a lot of opportunities, and the opportunity in particular to be in opposition to the House leadership might bring back some of those more assertive tendencies in that office. I certainly share your frustration with the House Judiciary essentially not having more room to run in the last Congress. When the Democrats did hold Congress, they did largely squander that opportunity. Having said that, I think that the opportunity for divided government and for a House leadership that is from a party other than the president will create opportunities, at least for some members of Congress, if not Congressman Conyers, to be feisty, as you put it. And I think that the opportunity for oversight of the executive branch, while, you know, there is always a danger that these things descend into partisan witch hunts, and I don't want to see that happen, especially after the events in Tucson. But I do think that there are a lot of legitimate concerns with executive abuses, overreaches, waste, redundancy, duplication, secrecy, unaccountability, and I think that the introduction of a different partisan voice in the institutional dynamic could ultimately be a very good thing.
But it's hard to imagine, and I cannot think of a Republican, and I'll give benefit of the doubt to the freshmen, because I have no knowledge of most of them, but I can't think of a single Republican who has stood firm for our Fourth Amendment rights, who has argued to roll back the intrusive use of national security letters, for example.
Originally authorized.
Paul. Okay, thank you. I'll give you $100 for a second one.
Unfortunately, the list runs not particularly deep. I think he, and you're right, the NSLs and all the other abuses have really been taken in stride by the GOP. And I read a really interesting post by Glenn Greenwald not too long ago, and he, I think the title of it was something to the effect of Cheney Vindicated. And basically, the right wing and the architects of the Bush administration have been quite public in their praise recently for the Obama administration and its continuity of the war on terror. And, despite the promises of change we can believe in and the transition in Washington 2 years ago, we really do remain substantively, with respect to our constitutional rights and the balance of power between the executive and the constitutional rights of everyday Americans, in quite frankly a worse place than we were under the Bush administration. And I think that's quite frankly terrifying.
Shahid, when I daydream, and it's only occasionally, I imagine what America would be like if Glenn Greenwald were the Attorney General. And I hope that people do follow...
Very different.
I do hope that people follow his work at Salon.com, because on a daily, if not weekly, basis, he offers very sharp and intelligent criticism of these issues, the Constitution, law enforcement, police, and judicial activities. And I just think that his is a very important voice on these matters. And the column that you're citing, where he quoted comments from Dick Cheney, who's darn pleased at the work that Obama has done to cover up the crimes of the Bush era, to extend, I don't think that Obama intended to keep Guantanamo open, but since he hasn't closed it, he gets praise from Cheney and people like him. And there was a reunion of the Poppy Bush military team, including Cheney, and others in Texas just the other day to celebrate the glories of Operation Desert Storm. And when you look at it in that long time frame, you see how Cheney inserted himself as W's vice president when he was just supposed to be heading up the search. And he did so to protect the legacy of the work that he and Rumsfeld started back way back in the Gerald Ford White House. And their desire was to expand executive authority, increase the military budget, and use it to promote U.S. dominance of world oil supplies, and to suppress dissent in the United States using the means that are largely enabled by the Patriot Act and similar legislation.
That's right, and I think one thing I just add there is that in the rush to expand the military budget, there's also an effort simultaneously to downsize it and outsource its activities to private contractors. So it's kind of like hijacking the state to make the private sector rich. And I basically see that as a form of kleptocracy. And one of the dangers, this comes out less with Patriot, though it's implicated more with FISA and other programs that rely on the participation of contractors. You know, there is a really profound problem, not just with a military-industrial complex of the sort that President Eisenhower warned us regarding foreign interests of the United States, but increasingly a domestic intelligence-industrial complex operating here at home, surveilling pervasively law-abiding people. There are another couple. We were talking about Glenn Greenwald just now. You know, two other journalists whose work is worth mentioning here. One, Dana Priest and William Arkin at the Washington Post have done a really fantastic series called Top Secret America, the most recent article of which, Monitoring Americans, gets into this. And some of this relates to Patriot. A lot of it also relates, again, to other programs that make Patriot worse,
right,
like fusion centers or the Joint Terrorism Task Forces that I referred to very briefly in the rhyme. Those sorts of programs are, again, worse than the sum of their parts. And another person who comes to mind here when we were talking about voices on the conservative side of the aisle who have been very principled and mindful of their constitutional responsibilities, this is not an office holder, but like Glenn, a voice in media, Julian Sanchez, who is a fellow at the Cato Institute, is also a very dedicated populist. And I think of these issues less and less of Democrat versus Republican precisely because so many Democrats and so many Republicans are in bed with that intelligence industrial complex. I think of it much more as a struggle on both sides of the aisle between populists, you know, people like you and I, people who do believe in the values that made our country great, and then on the other side, essentially corporatists in each of those parties, right? Whether they are the sort of defense contractors or whether it's Wall Street, who have, you know, increasingly, I think, taken to basically stealing from the rest of us through the state.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that on that sort of meta level, this is a struggle that has implications far beyond the mere policy question on the table. You know, if the question on the table is, will the Fourth Amendment have any relevance to you and I and our children, in 10, 20 years from now, will the Fourth Amendment remain part of America's constitutional commitment? The ultimate question on the table is even grander, I think, than that.
Yeah. Shahid, I just want to remind our listeners to take a moment to click on the link and watch the video of your talk and rhyming at the FBI building on Martin Luther King Day. And when you watch it on YouTube, there's an opportunity at the end of it to click on a video from your appearance on Fox News with Sean Hannity 6 years ago. And, man, you did a great job taking on that monster as he attempted to marginalize you and turn you into an architect of anarchy. So that's just in passing. I want people to take a look at that. But two of the things that I'd like to focus on that you mentioned as you were rhyming there. One is that taking photographs in public is now subject to scrutiny or control by local police authorities. And it's interesting because a couple of months ago, Sibel Edmonds and I interviewed Carlos Miller, who is an activist in Miami, Florida. He is a photojournalist, And he, on more than one occasion, was stopped by Miami police and Miami-Dade Transit police for taking pictures in public of public facilities. And he is a credentialed journalist. He offered his identification, and it led to a lengthy court case that he ultimately prevailed in. And then just a month ago, two journalist friends of mine here on the West Coast, Peter Laufer and Terry Phillips, co-authored an op-ed piece that was run in the San Francisco Chronicle about how they were stopped by police officers in San Francisco as they were taking some innocuous pictures of a public parking garage. And Miller, at his website, and I'll find the link and put it in the show file with this podcast, but at his website, he has been collecting these stories, and it happens in Philadelphia, and it's happening in Chicago, and we're seeing a crackdown on, and this is at a time when the people have more cameras than ever before. Every phone's got a camera, everybody's got a digital camera, and they are cracking down on what is clearly a constitutional right.
It's interesting, too, yeah, and you're right that it's happening around the country. The reference to the 800,000 police across the country monitoring your activities is the Suspicious Activity Reporting Program, which is run through the Director of National Intelligence and fusion centers around the country, which basically collect all the different police departments and sheriff's offices and state highway patrols and the federal agencies. And the idea is that they are tracking activity which is not criminal. And there's two sides to this equation that are really problematic. The first is the liberty side, the over-inclusion. So obviously, since they're tracking activity that's not criminal, and they're doing this everywhere, they're tracking information about a lot of people who don't present any threat, people who are just going about our lives. And it's not just taking pictures. It's taking pictures, it's taking video, drawing, taking notes. You know, all of these are activities that are deemed suspicious in the list. And so there's that over-inclusion. There's a particular problem there also, which is that when everyone has a camera, when everyone is drawing, you know, who are the people who are being tracked? It may not be just everyone. And to be fair, I do know cases of, you know, white Americans being stopped for these activities. But profiling becomes a particular problem here because it's such a ubiquitous, pervasive activity when the police are choosing who to scrutinize and who to interrogate. You know, oftentimes that will be decided on the basis of their biases. All that's on one side of the equation. The other side of the equation, the security equation, is equally dubious because the effort, the reason why they're collecting all this information and feeding into the government databases is essentially on a theory, the mosaic theory, that is not unlike the algorithms powering the search engines that serve you sponsored ads online, in that they want to put dots together. They want to figure out, well, you know, if terrorists go to Dunkin' Donuts and, you know, watch The Simpsons, then we need to track people who go to Dunkin' Donuts and watch The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Right? Except it's not that simple. Mm-hmm. And here's why. In the commercial context, you have a million hits. Lots of people buy things, so you can see what lots of people doing things do, and you can draw trends. In the terrorism context, for all the bluster we hear about, it doesn't happen that often, which is to say there aren't a lot of examples from which to try to draw predictive conclusions. Data mining as an enterprise is bankrupt. It is a giant sham. And it is a very expensive one that all of us are paying for in taxpayer dollars. And some companies in the intelligence industrial complex are getting very rich by skimming off the fat, essentially, of what used to be our rights.
Mm-hmm. Shahid, you also make reference in an indictable fashion to thought crimes. And this is a very important area because as Americans, we have, up till recently, enjoyed unlimited liberty in terms of what we think and, with narrow exceptions, how we express it. But what we're seeing is that we are criminalizing people for ideas, for expressions that don't amount to actual threats or an active plan to commit a crime or some other infraction or act of violence. And this is a very critical area because I believe that at the same time Americans are being pacified or narcotized by television and films and other entertainments and distractions, that we are seeing people led away for what they think and what they have expressed. And the most visible example is the crackdown on peace activists that occurred in Chicago and in Wisconsin over the last 3 or 4 months. You and I talked about it when we last spoke in October. But this is a very serious problem where these people have been subjected to heavy-handed law enforcement tactics when there is no charge or even suggestion that they've committed a crime.
That's right. And not only have they committed no crime, but until very recently, everything they were doing, as far as we know, was constitutionally protected under the First Amendment. Right? We were talking earlier about how the Fourth Amendment has been impacted by the Patriot Act. The First Amendment has, too. The Patriot Act expanded the provisions under which the government can prosecute people for what they call material support for terrorism. And that could include something as innocuous as donating money for blankets in a humanitarian aid crisis if the people who end up with the blankets are part of the group designated by the Office of Foreign Asset Control as a terrorist organization. And what's scary here is the very overt risk of politicization, and I fear it is upon us. So, for instance, last year, the case that rendered the First Amendment inoperable in this arena, the case that upheld the material support standard against the group that was prosecuted for trying to promote nonviolence in Turkey. They were a nonviolent peace group trying to promote nonviolence who were, you know, accused of material support for terrorism. That law withstood the court challenge. And ever since the Humanitarian Law Project case, anyone who does solidarity work with groups in Colombia and Latin America, groups in the Middle East, humanitarian assistance, all of that is potentially criminal. And meanwhile, just last month, it was in Paris, Attorney General Michael Mukasey, former Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge, and Rudy Giuliani all spoke at a fundraiser for a Paris group that has been designated by the Office of Foreign Asset Control as a terrorist organization.
Right.
As far as I know, none of them have faced prosecution. It's not unlike the torture regime where, you know, the Ninth Circuit judge, Jay Bybee, is a war criminal and he's passing judgment on the rest of us. You know, it's mass incarceration if you're a normal, everyday person, even if you're doing nothing wrong, it's still intelligence collection of everyday people, while the powerful decision makers in our society are essentially held above the law. And I think the crisis in the rule of law beyond, you know, just these particular amendments I'm talking about in the constitutional rights, and I really fear that we are devolving into a banana republic before our very eyes.
And Shahid, we are not simply whiny professional lefties. You have some courses of action that people can participate in. And first up, you're sponsoring a lobbying day on Capitol Hill this coming Thursday, January 27th. And people can get more information at your website, which is BORDC.org, stands for Bill of Rights Defense Committee.org. Tell us how people can support this effort, either by joining you in Washington, if they're able, or remotely, if that's the only available option for them.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyone who can make it to Washington on Thursday will be more than merely welcome. We'll host a policy briefing in the morning. We'll set up meetings with your congressional representatives and senators and support you in an effort to make your views heard, supply you with materials. We'll have a lunch afterward to debrief and plot next steps. And then for folks who can't join us in Washington, we do have a letter that we'll be delivering to members of Congress. It's primarily addressed to the Attorney General, but we're CCing members of Congress, and it basically calls for changes in policies and personnel at the FBI. You know, a lot of people are concerned, for instance, about the peace activists that have been raided and brought before secret grand juries. A lot of people are concerned about the Muslim American communities that have been treated as objects of presumptive guilt. For all the concerns around those particular communities, to fix those abuses, we really need to change the policies that enable them. And so we've got a letter that basically makes that request to the Attorney General, and anyone can sign it. It's online, again, at borgc.org. And so you can be represented virtually by adding your voice to the chorus, even if you can't make it to our nation's capital.
And one of the other actions that people can take at a local level is what you're calling the Local Civil Rights Restoration Act. And this is intended to be presented to city councils, county boards, and other government entities. I'm sure state legislatures would be appropriate as well, if people can get traction there. But describe what you're talking about in the Civil Rights Restoration Act idea.
Absolutely. And let's do this from two angles. One is the policy angle. I'll explain what it does. And then the other is the organizing angle, and I'll explain why it's significant. What the bill does is a series of things. One, with respect to the intelligence collection that we were talking about, it prevents local police agencies from collecting intelligence information unless they have reasonable suspicion that there is criminal activity, right? So basically, taking pictures can't be a reason for the police to stop and interrogate you. Crossing the street with a beard stops being a reason for the police to randomly and arbitrarily collect information about people and their lawful activity. So that's one piece, the intelligence collection. Mm-hmm. There's another part of the bill that relates to racial profiling, not just in any particular context, but all of them. So whether it's the war on drugs or the war on terror or the war on immigrants, it requires police to document their basis for suspicion and to report to the local legislature, the city council is usually, or the town halls in the Northeast, aggregate data showing the races and the demographic information in the aggregate about the people who were stopped or searched or arrested, subjected to force, people who are ultimately charged with a criminal offense. And so it brings transparency to police operations that are generally currently secret. We don't even know in most towns how bad racial profiling is happening, or for that matter, where in the equation it manifests, right? People are familiar with driving while black. Racial profiling is much bigger than that, right? And that's one example of what happened. It's also, you know, you can see police use disparate uses of force, right? So if police are much quicker, basically shoot or beat people up in some neighborhoods than others, that's racial profiling too. And if police are more likely to infiltrate the faith institutions of one group rather than another, that's also racial profiling. It's not racial, that's religious profiling, but the bill addresses all of that. Mm-hmm. So it's intelligence collection, it's profiling, and then the third piece relates particularly to immigration enforcement, and it sets up a wall between local police and ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, to make sure the local police don't get stuck in this business that the federal government under President Obama is increasingly engaged in of trying quite viciously to deport people, particularly of Latino descent, and even U.S. citizens of Latino descent, getting oftentimes caught up in those gears.
Mm-hmm. And I think these are both strong efforts. I think we need to call attention in Washington. I think we also need to activate people at the local level, because it's going to take a long time and a sustained effort to unravel the serious damage that has been done to our constitutional rights and our civil liberties. And we need to call attention, because far too many people are complacent or even oblivious to the threats that they face in asserting their constitutional rights and their personal liberties in this current climate.
You're absolutely right. And just to press on one piece of that, the opportunity and the real need, I think, for local action, at least on the progressive side of the aisle, for the last two generations, I would say, there has been a sustained demobilization. And you really see that now, where at the federal level, it is really only on one side of the political aisle that populist grassroots are able to project influence. And it's not the progressive one. And I think the need for people on their local communities to find those allegiances across the aisle, right, because a lot of conservatives and a lot of progressives share these interests to not be watched when they're not doing anything wrong, to not be tracked, to not have their financial information routinely or, reported to the government. And I think that the opportunity to reach out across the different communities that share an interest in broad-based civil rights reforms, right, because that's going to be Latino immigrant communities, that's going to be Muslim and Arab and South Asian communities. That's going to be African American communities. That's going to be white civil libertarian communities, right? People who, you know, would say, get off my land, right? They share an interest in privacy. And I think it's while at the federal level, those kinds of allegiances are very tough to build. You know, and with the Patriot Act coming up for reauthorization, the one hope we have, quite frankly, is for a progressive and libertarian alliance in the House to insist on amendments. I don't know how likely that is, but whereas at the federal level, that's really difficult to pull off, at the local level, it's really not, right? I mean, instead of there being 530 members of Congress, you're dealing with like 10 city council people, and instead of those members of Congress representing 100,000 people, or in the case of senators, many millions each, you know, they might represent 10,000 or a few thousand, or even small towns, a couple hundred, and you can get to them. You don't need to have huge amounts of money for campaign contributions or huge numbers of people to show up at a rally. Sometimes with city council people, you can just go knock on their door.
That's right.
And if the opportunity, I think, to have a vehicle to go not just to your city council people and your local office holders, but also to the activists and the community leaders of other communities to go to a mosque with this and say, listen, you know, I care about my privacy. I care about your rights, too. How about we stand together on this, you know, to go to the local NAACP chapter, to go to the local Peace and Justice Coalition, the local immigrant rights group, the student groups that care about this, interfaith organizations. All of these communities share an interest in constitutional rights. And because we all face different abuses by different three-letter agencies or local agencies, I think we've not been able to muster the support for constitutional rights that, that you and I certainly would like to see. And the opportunity for local activism fills that gap. And I think especially a broad-based platform of this sort. We're working with groups in 20 different cities right now across the country, in the Northeast, in the Southeast, on the West Coast, in the Midwest, in the South, and you know, campaigns of all different kinds. And we're very eager to hear from people who are interested in serving as a point of local contact, rolling up their sleeves and seeing what we can do as a grassroots movement to defend civil liberties.
Well, Shahid, I really appreciate what you're doing, and I want our listeners to support this. So again, the website, bordc.org, for absolutely free. You can sign up to get their alerts and newsletters, and I'm on that list. I find it very helpful, and I'd like people to support the work that you're doing. And either in concert or independently, I urge each listener to contact their member of Congress and say, do not renew the Patriot Act without amendments. I mean, I'd like to see the whole thing scuttled. But what's achievable at this point is to draw attention to the most egregious parts of the Patriot Act and try to build, as you said, this progressive libertarian coalition really try to address these issues and see if we can get back on a constitutional footing. Shahid, as we wrap up, anything you'd like to add?
Just that hope is not yet lost, right? A lot of people care about these issues, and if you're listening and this is something that concerns you, don't just yell at the television. Don't just get angry. Get active and reach out if you need support. We and certainly other organizations are eager to help support you, and I think that while a lot of these issues can seem very terrifying and daunting, you know, it is a Goliath, an institutional Goliath that we face. I do think that we, the people, have it in us and can protect our rights in the 21st century.
Shahid Buttar, Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Always great to talk with you. We will continue to conspire.
I look forward to it. Thank you, Peter. Don't get tough. The tough get going, 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 going.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. It was a year ago that the going got tough when the Roberts Supreme Court ruled in favor of corporate interests and against the interests of you and me in the Citizens United case, where they essentially allowed corporations to get directly involved in funding candidate election campaigns. In the past, they could participate, but they had to do it through political action committees, and there were limitations and restrictions. It's now just a wild, wild west. And we saw it here in California as Meg Whitman spent $160 million, mostly her own money. But also Carly Fiorina tried to defeat Senator Barbara Boxer, And she was aided and abetted by those who took advantage of the new rules, including Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS, the Chamber of Commerce, and many other corporate groups. Well, there is a move afoot to amend the Constitution to overturn, essentially, the impact of the Citizens United decision. And joining us, two activists who are a part of this effort, Ben and Jerry, Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield. Gentlemen, welcome to our program today.
How you doing, Peter?
Hello!
Good to talk to you both, and I have had the pleasure of talking with Ben in the past, and I will offer the same confession that I named my love handles Ben on the left and Jerry on the right.
Ah, that's cute.
I've been consuming your products. I love premium ice cream. You guys make some of the best, and you keep doing it. That new caramel fudge swirl flavor.
Good taste. Clearly, you are an ice cream aficionado.
Well, you know, Cherry Garcia is my mainstay, and I have to give credit. I got started when I grew up in Cincinnati with a great ice cream there called Graters. Have you guys ever tried that?
Yep, I have tried Graters. It is excellent ice cream.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, enough about my predilection for late-night raids of the freezer. What we're talking about is an effort to rebuild our democracy because the Roberts Supreme Court decision in Citizens United seriously undermined it. Ben, first, what do you see as the real negative impacts of Citizens United?
Well, I think that the major problem with the country has been that corporations have been getting more and more powerful, that they've been essentially running the country. And this decision in Citizens United just makes it a whole lot worse and raises it to a whole new level. You know, the idea that corporations can use all their resources to sway elections is, I think, un-American and undemocratic.
Jerry, your comment?
Yeah. You know, the idea is that we're supposed to have a government of the people, by the people, for the people. And due to some strange quirk, corporations are now considered to be people. And I think we all know there's a big difference between a person, a human being, and a corporation, and yet somehow corporations are being seen as people and being afforded the rights of people.
Jerry, can you lean in a little closer? It's hard to hear you. Sorry.
No problem.
That's great.
I was saying that corporations are now being seen as people and being afforded the rights of humans, and they simply are not. They're a for-profit entity that kind of looks out for themselves and not for the common good.
And what's remarkable is that prior to that, there was this decision from back in the 1880s, Santa Clara County, which is where San Jose is, versus the Southern Pacific Railroad. And that's where this legal concept of corporate personhood arose. But the Roberts decision in Citizens United really put a different face on corporate personhood because of the resources that they can bring to the political process. And during this past cycle, we did see what's left of organized labor step up and try to counter the pernicious influence of corporate money. And one of the problems is that it's often spent in the most destructive ways. And that's something that I don't hold the court responsible for. But by unleashing the floodgates of corporate money, what we've done is funded the attack ads that really are part of the background noise that I see as a contributor to the attempt to murder Congresswoman Giffords in Tucson less than 2 weeks ago. Ben, your comment?
I don't know if this has made the environment more likely to have what happened in Tucson go on. I think that the vitriolic political discourse has certainly contributed to that environment that led to that horrible massacre. but I don't think that this particular Supreme Court decision really made that worse. I mean, I hope that that corporations would not be would not be as openly putting targets on people's heads as happened in this case.
Well, but Jerry, virtually all of the money that Karl Rove's group spent and the money spent by the Chamber of Commerce, much of which we don't know the source of because of the way they used phony nonprofits to disguise who donated, most of that money was used for negative ads that were aimed at destroying Democratic candidates. And so it is, you know, very clearly a very powerful weapon. And it's not being used to promote good government or to even promote candidates favored by these corporations. It's really used to fuel what Bill Clinton called the politics of personal destruction.
Yeah, well, you know, the point to me is that corporations and business in general, no matter what their viewpoints are and no matter what end of the political spectrum they're on, they should not be involved in influencing elections or supporting political parties. It's just not what was intended by the founding fathers. There was nothing written in about corporations, and somehow this has now been interpreted by the Supreme Court. And, you know, one thing we should keep in mind about this decision from last year was it was a 5-4 decision on the court. It's not as if the Supreme Court unanimously said, boy, we ought to do this.
Right.
And the dissenting opinions talk about what a misguided decision was made.
And so Ben and Jerry with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show. On Friday, January 21st, you're participating in a news conference in Washington. And alongside you will be Jim Hightower, the great populist and a promoter of great aphorisms and little slogans. He's going to be there with you. Jeffrey Hollander, the co-founder of Seventh Generation and American Sustainable Business Council, and Robert Weissman, the president of Public Citizen. And what is it, gentlemen, that you plan to propose?
Well, what we're doing is we're announcing the beginning of a campaign to bring together corporations that are against this Supreme Court ruling. And that will eventually support a movement to amend the Constitution, if that's what's necessary, to make it so that corporations don't end up controlling our elections the same way they're controlling the rest of our lives as Americans.
There's actually a lot of activity that's going to be taking place in Washington, D.C. on Friday around the anniversary of this decision. There's going to be a lot of citizens groups, grassroots groups, and what Ben and Jerry's and a bunch of other businesses are involved in is the kickoff of this campaign of businesses and business leaders to have business add its voice to these progressive groups who are saying this is not the way the decision should have been, and we need to change it.
And other than you and other progressives who have been successful in the corporate world, Ben, first, do you sense that there are corporate leaders who don't want to be involved in politics and who view this as a burden or a liability?
Well, I think there's a lot of corporations that don't believe they should be involved in electing candidates and influencing political elections. As a matter of fact, the corporation that now owns Ben and Jerry's, Unilever,
right,
has a official corporate policy of not contributing to any political campaign.
And did you have something to do with that?
Nope. They had that
really?
Policy in place, I believe, before we ever came on the scene.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And, you know, as Ben mentioned, this campaign is being organized by the American Sustainable Business Council.
mm-hmm.
will be at the event, and they represent over 60,000 businesses. So, in my mind, when I think about businesses that want to be making large campaign contributions, they tend to be these enormous corporations. But if you think about business in this country, the huge majority of them are small and medium-sized businesses who don't necessarily have those resources and don't want to be putting those resources
mm-hmm.
towards elections. And we just need to get them activated and on the train.
And how do we take on the outsized influence of the Koch brothers? Common Cause has gone public today, calling for an investigation of the linkage between the Koch brothers and an annual conference they hold, and two of the most conservative members of the Supreme Court, Justices Scalia and Thomas, who have been attending these meetings, but they're not public. We don't know the extent to which they may have been discussing issues like Citizens United. We know that the Koch brothers put tons of money into the political campaigns of conservative Republicans. And as I referenced at the start of our conversation, here in California, we saw that very sharply with Carly Fiorina, because just a week after she came out in opposition to Proposition 23, which was promoted by oil companies, they bought and paid for it, put it on the ballot here, and it was to undo the only good thing that Arnold Schwarzenegger did while he was governor, which was to pass a AB 32, which addresses global warming and produces a California cap-and-trade system that is just starting to be devised and will go into effect in the next couple of years. And just a week after Fiorina finally came down off the fence and said she was going to oppose Prop 23, she was invited to a big fundraiser in Washington, D.C., hosted by the Koch brothers. And they, too, fund Americans for Prosperity, which has funded the phony grassroots groups that disrupted the town hall meetings over health care starting in the summer of 2009. And they do a lot of other work, too, through Washington think tanks and front groups like Dick Armey's most recent incarnation. So the network that they have is very powerful, very well connected, and it leads me to believe, Jerry, that the first line here is to amend the Constitution, because working through the Congress that depends on campaign contributions and working through a Supreme Court, even though there are two new members who we don't know exactly how they would vote. Well, one, we don't know how Elena Kagan would vote on Citizens United. It still seems to me that while amending the Constitution is not easy, that that is the straightest route to correcting this problem that came from the court.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's the current thinking of people that want to change this Citizens United decision, is that the best way to do it is with an amendment to the Constitution. As you say, it's not easy, but it can be done. And after this particular Supreme Court decision a year ago, there was a poll done by the Washington Post which said that 80% of the population disagreed with it. So certainly the people feel this way about it. It's going through the process of doing that amendment.
And there's a group called Move to Amend, and I want to credit David Cobb from Eureka, California, who has been on the forefront ever since Citizens United's the decision was announced by the Supreme Court. And they and others have collected over 750,000 signatures of people who support the notion of amending the Constitution to rein in corporate spending on our election process. And there are a lot of other great groups, too. I'll list them in the show file related to this podcast at peterbcollins.com. But I'm glad to see most of the progressive organizations are rallying around this issue and participating in the events in Washington here at the end of this week, the 21st of January. And Ben, speak to my listeners here. How would you like them to get involved? And you've been running True Majority, and you've been very active in progressive politics through the very dark years of the Bush era. What is your call to action for the people listening today?
Well, I think if you're at all involved with any kind of business, or if you patronize a business, to encourage them to go to businessfordemocracy.com. And that's where businesses can sign up, sign on to a statement in support of this activity. And I think if you're not looking to involve a business, Move to Amend is probably the best place to go to. I think we should also reference the American Sustainable Business Council, which will be taking a leadership role in terms of getting the business community on board and raising their voice to change this law.
And Jerry, what is your advice to our listeners here about how they can get involved to make an important change?
I'm going to second what Ben said. I think encouraging businesses that you spend money at to go to businessfordemocracy.com. You know, this is not just a progressive issue. This is a mainstream issue. Yes, it's important for progressives, but just maintaining our democracy, having a democracy that is vibrant and works and is not controlled by corporations, is essential to what we're doing. So everybody needs to be speaking up about this.
Well, gentlemen, I appreciate your energy and the resources that you're putting into this. I thank you for talking with me today. And I remain at your disposal. This is going to be a long effort. As we mentioned, amending the Constitution requires action in two-thirds of the state legislatures across the country. And then it leads to a constitutional convention. It's a long and arduous process. But if we are going to regain and try to preserve the notions of democracy that were in place just a year ago, this is a struggle I think we need to take on. Ben, a final comment?
Well, I think the main thing is that the Constitution was designed to be for people, we the people, people who have hearts and spirits and souls. And corporations don't have those.
And Jerry, your final comment?
It is a long road, but it's already started. Things are going well. Just yesterday in the Vermont legislature, where Ben and I live, a Vermont state senator already proposed a law that that the Vermont legislature could support. And so there needs to be support from, I don't know, how many states, two-thirds, three-quarters, whatever you constitutional people out there know about, but
I think it's two-thirds, if I remember correctly.
You know, it's already being proposed in Vermont, so we're moving forward here.
All right. Well, Ben and Jerry, thanks again for your time today, and keep on pushing. You've got us right behind you.
Beautiful.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Peter B. Collins Show. Stand up for your rights, and hey, send me an email, humblehost@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you. Until we meet again, happy trails to you. Keep smiling.